You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi begins her tour of Europe, we'll be finding out what to expect. From one country still under authoritarian rule to another that recently turned a corner, we'll be discussing a fascinating new exhibition of the Gaddafi archives, hundreds of photos, documents and artifacts linked to Muammar Gaddafi discovered during the revolution in Libya.
One photo that really stood out for me was a picture of a young King Idris together with a young woman who looked familiar. And it took me quite a while to realize that it is a picture of a young Queen Elizabeth just after she came to power.
Then we'll cross to New York to talk to the curator of a new festival of films about journalism. It's not all His Girl Friday and all the President's Men.
Why didn't you get this?
I don't know.
Do you have phone numbers for all your sources on the hack, haven't we? Because somebody wants to do some kind of follow-up story.
Called all the hackers I know, asking if any had heard of a hacker by the name of Big Bad Bionic Boy. Nothing.
That was a clip from the film Shattered Glass. Our design editor Hugo MacDonald will also be popping in to chat about the London Architecture Awards, and I'll be playing a couple of songs. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But first, here's Barney Burnham with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News at 6, I'm Barney Burnham. The Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi has been addressing the International Labour Organization conference in Geneva on the first day of her European tour. Over the next 2.5 weeks, she'll be visiting Norway, Britain, Ireland and France. It's only the second trip she's taken out of Burma in almost a quarter of a century, having spent many years under house arrest under the rule of an authoritarian military junta. She said enormous progress has since been made towards political reform in the country, and her eyes are firmly on the future.
There's a wide range of reforms that could be undertaken in Burma, not just to make investment attractive, but to make it sustainable and truly beneficial for our people. A democracy-friendly development policy of coordinated social, political, and economic reform will put our country once again on the map of the positive and the successful.
The French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius says he's to propose giving the United Nations the power to enforce Kofi Annan's Syrian peace plan. He says a no-fly zone is an option under consideration to stem what is now a civil war. His comments were the toughest yet from a major power in response to the relentless violence in Syria. 50 international aid groups and United Nations agencies have issued a joint appeal calling on Israel to lift its blockade of the Gaza Strip, which is ruled by Hamas Islamists. Amongst the signatories were Amnesty International, Save the Children, the World Health Organization, Oxfam, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and five other UN bodies. Charles de Salvia, representative of international NGOs in Gaza, says the blockade has had a particularly serious effect on water supplies there.
Now today, 95% of the coastal aquifer, 95%, the sole source of fresh water available for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, is not safe to drink.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron has told the Leveson inquiry into media standards that his predecessor Gordon Brown had cooked up a specious and unjustified conspiracy theory about a deal between the Conservatives and media group News International. Mr. Brown had told the inquiry that the Tories agreed to cut funding for the BBC and media regulator Ofcom in return for political support from News International. But Mr. Cameron said the suggestion was complete nonsense, adding that he'd never traded a policy in return for media backing. Mr. Cameron also said that he would never have given Jeremy Hunt the job of Culture Secretary had he been told that he could not oversee News International's bid to take over B Sky B. And the inquiry heard that a text message from the former News International executive Rebecca Brooks told Mr. Cameron she was rooting for him both professionally and personally after the Sun newspaper switched its allegiance from Labour to the Conservatives. Egypt's ruling military council has gone into an emergency session after the country's Supreme Court ordered the lower house of parliament to be dissolved. The court ruled that last year's election was unconstitutional and a third of the seats elected under the first-past-the-post system were illegitimate. The Muslim Brotherhood had won many of the seats which had been judged unconstitutional. The court also ruled that a law banning senior officials from President Mubarak's regime from standing for office was unconstitutional. That ruling means that former Prime Minister Ahmed Shafiq can stay in this weekend's presidential election. He's in a tight runoff against the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi after last month's first round of voting. Pakistan's foreign minister says NATO should apologise for an airstrike which killed two dozen of its soldiers last year if it wants her government to reopen transit routes to foreign troops in Afghanistan. Those routes have been closed for some time, and NATO's Secretary General said yesterday that reopening them would greatly assist the withdrawal of troops and equipment when NATO begins to wind down its mission. Hina Rabbani says Pakistan has every right to seek an apology for the strike on Salalah.
That doesn't look like a very unreasonable request. You know, when you... So we thought it was not very unreasonable and we could move on from there. After that, they said that the Salalah type of incidents must not happen again. I mean, is there anybody in the world who can agree or disagree, you know, who can disagree with that and who wants to say no, Salalah type of incidents must happen again? They help all of us.
South Africa's new National Police Commissioner says she's determined to root out corruption. Mangwashi Ria-Fiega, who's the first woman to hold the job, was appointed after her predecessor was fired by President Zuma on Tuesday. She previously worked in business before the president picked her to chair the state-owned Enterprises Review Committee, but she says she's now ready for the challenges of her new job.
I'd like to join those national forces that are saying this is an ill that requires serious penicillin, so that we can sustain the future of this country. No criminal must feel comfortable in our country. All criminals should know that the 49 million citizens of this country are not welcoming them.
And those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. It is 7 minutes past five in the morning in Auckland, 20:07 in Istanbul and 18:07 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. As a Monocle 24.
Welcome to Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Brussels, Monocle 24.
Lontoosta käsin, tämä on Monocle 24.
Londonbo, as a Monocle 24.
Londadan, burası Monocle 24.
Londonist, siinä on Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que kinina teiro noa, Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes es Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En a Monocle 24 tagat, ja.
In the days following the fall of the Libyan city Benghazi, government buildings were ransacked, regime officials were arrested, and hidden arms caches were uncovered. Amid the chaos, Peter Boquet, Emergencies Director for Human Rights Watch, began to uncover a series of photographs, documents and artefacts which documented the rise and fall of Libya's then leader Muammar Gaddafi. As the uprising spread and the regime eventually crumbled, Boquet continued to find astonishing evidence from MI6 letters to old Gaddafi family photos. He tried to photograph and record as many items as possible, and the result is a new exhibition, the Gaddafi Archives, which opens in London next week. A little earlier, I spoke to Peter in Geneva.
I was in Libya for quite a bit of last year during the revolution. And when I arrived in the city of Benghazi in February, we found many of the intelligence buildings already burned down. But as we started speaking to activists and local residents in Benghazi, we started coming across these small archives and pieces of archives which had been rescued by local people. And they showed very little interest in the pictures. I remember one man came to my hotel with a stack of about 200 pictures, and he said, well, they're just pictures of Gaddafi. But when we started looking through them, we realized that they had a great historic importance.
And let's talk about that historic importance. I mean, what sort of things did you find in these pictures? What sort of scenes did they depict?
Well, as we traveled through Libya, we came across many more of these archives. Some of them were rooms full of albums and just photographs stacked everywhere. They document both the late regime of the last king of Libya, King Idris, the coming to power of Gaddafi in a military coup, his relationship and friendship with Nasser at the height of the Arab nationalist movement, and then his later period, his visits to the Soviet Union, to Eastern Germany, meetings with Arafat, and just many private moments as well of him with his children and his family, a real insight into a society which had been closed off from the West for so long.
Now, with these photos, the originals, obviously you took pictures of the pictures, as it were. What happened to the originals?
Well, for Human Rights Watch, it was very important that we did not remove these objects and these archives from Libya. They belong to the Libyan people, and they have to be preserved for the Libyan people. But they were at great risk. So, you know, I remember I walked through the house of Hannibal Gaddafi, the son of Muammar Gaddafi, together with some local Libyans in September after Tripoli fell. And the local Libyans were just picking up any depiction of Gaddafi they came across and ripped it up in front of me. So we knew we were in a race against time. We photographed as many of these pictures as we could. It was quite an immense task. And then we informed the local authorities, the Transitional Council, about the location of these archives. We collected some of the pictures and handed them over to them to make sure that they would be preserved for the future.
And let's talk about some of the individual photos. Are there any that particularly stand out for you, which you think, which either surprised you or you think sort of summed up what Gaddafi was like?
Well, one photo that really stood out for me was a picture of a young King Idris together with a young woman who looked familiar. And it took me quite a while to realize that it is a picture of a young Queen Elizabeth just after she came to power on one of her first foreign visits to Libya. So there were real gems in this archive. And one of the challenges we had is that almost none of the pictures we found had any information about where they were taken and what they depicted. So we had to consult with a lot of experts to identify the people in the images and to place them in their proper historic context. I think one of the most remarkable series that we found of Gaddafi is of a relatively young Gaddafi relaxing in the desert in Libya with a group of friends, barefoot, reading a book while reclining. There's one of him praying by himself in the desert. But they offer a remarkable insight into the life of Gaddafi and the cult which was built around Gaddafi. And then we also found many images of shocking atrocities. We found a videotape of a public televised trial of some opposition figures in 1984, which was held in a high school stadium in the city of Benghazi. And there's many students in the audience as these men are forced to make their confessions and ultimately hung. So there's also many reminders of just how brutal the Gaddafi regime was.
Now, you mentioned before that people were trying to rip up these photos, that whenever you found some, you would inform the local authorities. Do you know sort of how successful those attempts to persuade them to look after them were? I mean, are many of these photos now being kept in some sort of temporary national archive at all in Libya?
Well, at least some of the larger archives we identified have been preserved and are now under the protection of the transitional authorities. We think it's also important to point out that there's many archives with documents. Among the documents I discovered during these searches was an archive of CIA and MI6 faxes which related to the illegal capture and rendition of opponents of Gaddafi, Islamist components, by MI6 and the CIA, which is the reason why there is currently Scotland Yard investigation into MI6 going on today. It's because we discovered these documents. But with those documents, the day after we found them, that building was put firmly under lock and key, and we hope that these important archives will one day be reopened to the Libyan public and to international scrutiny, because they contain many secrets that deserve to be revealed.
This exhibition is going to be in London later this month. Are there any plans at all to take this exhibition on the road, but in particular back to Libya?
We certainly would like to do so in the future. It has been quite exhausting and, I must say, heroic on the part of the curator effort to put this exhibit together with a very limited budget. It took a lot of work to identify the people in the pictures. And there's also now a very repressive law in place in Libya which prevents the glorification of Gaddafi. Certainly the purpose of this exhibition is not to glorify Gaddafi. It's to shed light into his 42 years of rule, and it includes many images of the brutality with which he ruled. But we would want to see some liberalization of the climate in Libya before we would mount the exhibit there, even though it's very important for the Libyan people to be able to see the secret history of their own country, because many of them have not seen any of these images.
That was Peter Burkett, Emergencies Director at Human Rights Watch. And if you're in London next week, you can see that exhibition at the Slade Research Centre at the Warburg Institute. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The Entrepreneurs is about finding the human face of successful businesses, meeting the men and women at the helm of enterprises with staying power, and handpicking the ideas that really matter amongst the hubbub. From international tech firms to setting up shop in your local community, we cover people-centred businesses, big and small, and gather a few pointers on how to strike out on your own along the way from the people who really know about self-started success.
Get big or die trying.
The latest edition of The Entrepreneurs looks at a man shining a light on Egypt's renewable energy industry. We'll also be looking at how sustainability can now underpin solid business strategy rather than being a boring chore standing in the way of growth. And we'll be talking South American opportunities with the man who's reshaped the Argentinian hospitality and food scene.
You have a way of looking at design and style that draws you in. You don't want to leave, you want to stay there because you're having a good time.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. Aung San Suu Kyi's last visit to Europe was in 1988, shortly before Burma's military junta put her under house arrest and imposed an incarceration that would, on and off, last for 24 years. Her historic European tour started today in Geneva and will take her to Britain, France, Ireland and Norway, where, finally, she will formally accept the Nobel Peace Prize she was awarded in absentia back in 1991. The 67-year-old activist was greeted by cheering crowds at UN offices in Geneva, and while her trip to Oslo to collect the Nobel will no doubt be a symbolic moment for Burma, Suu Kyi's message is clear. Her speech today was dedicated to the cause of eradicating forced labour in Burma, and as sectarian violence between Buddhists and Muslim Rohingya rocks the country, she is making the case for further aid and investment from the international community. To discuss the visit and its implications, we're joined now by Mark Farmaner, Director of Burma Campaign UK. Mark, welcome to Midori House. What do you think are the main aims for Suu Kyi in this trip? What is it that she's hoping to achieve?
Well, I think it gives her an opportunity to thank some of the countries that have supported the cause of human rights and democracy in Burma for so long. And at the same time, I think she wants to deliver what is a bit of a mixed message, that there has been change in Burma, and she wants the international community to support that change. But at the same time, she has some words of caution about a lot of problems remaining and the danger of over-optimism, that people are maybe getting a little bit carried away about the changes that have happened, and there is some unjustified optimism.
Well, let's talk about some of those challenges ahead. I mean, what are sort of the big things that she believes the international community should be focused on right now?
Well, a top priority for her is the poverty in the country. I met with her a month ago traveling to Burma, the first time I'd been allowed into the country for 8 years. And this was one of the things she was talking about, is particularly 75% of the population of Burma are farmers. There's been no support from the government for farmers at all. Many of them are living in extreme poverty. And she's very concerned about their situation and the fact that you now have some of the multinational companies that are looking at coming into Burma, particularly from China. They seem they want to introduce the large-scale agricultural farming that actually displaces local farmers and is bad for the environment. So that was a concern. And while she wants to see investment, she wants to see a kind of investment that produces jobs, respects human rights and the environment. And she told us that monitoring the kind of investment that comes into Burma was a top priority. I think one of the dangers that we've seen at Burma Campaign UK is that companies tend to look at Burma as a place where you can get natural resources on the cheap because the government is desperate for money, not money that they're going to spend on health and education, but on the military and on luxury homes. And that companies also see Burma as a place where there's no health and safety regulations, no environmental controls, labor is cheap, and people, they don't know what kind of rights they should have. So you can get cheap labor there as well.
When we look at a lot of Western countries talking about lifting their sanctions, allowing companies to go in, are there also concerns that the wrong type of investment, you mentioned the sort of money that might go direct to government through companies wanting to extract natural resources, may actually help prop up the military supported government?
I think you've seen investment in the past, although there's been some sanctions. A lot of these sanctions were actually fairly limited. There was still, even from the European Union, which is meant to have some of the stronger sanctions, they had no sanctions that would stop oil companies going into Burma, for example, and Total Oil from France has been there the whole time, pumping millions of dollars into the dictatorship, which has helped them to keep buying arms and helped them to stay in power. And you've seen now that the government has very slightly increased the budget for health and education, but they've also, from what we hear, increased the military budget as well. And that military is still being used to commit human rights abuses and keep the government in power. So there's a lot of concerns in that way. You don't have any way that the people in Burma can hold their government to account, although limited budgets are published. Even MPs are told when they're given budgets they're meant to vote on that you're not allowed to show this to anyone, including their constituents. So we still don't even know exactly where the government is spending its money. But we know that the Burmese army has been attacking the ethnic Kachin in northeast Burma for the past year now, and that there's horrific human rights abuses taking place there.
I mean, obviously, this trip is great for Aung San Suu Kyi herself. Particularly when she's going to go to Norway to pick up the Nobel Prize. It'll obviously be quite emotional when she comes back to Britain, where her husband was from and lived until recently. I mean, do you get a sense that people back in Burma see this trip as being important for the country as well, or is it more of a personal trip for her?
In Burma, there are mixed feelings. I mean, people are very excited about her going abroad, and they have great hope in her. But there's even some people in Burma who have criticised her for going abroad, saying, why is she going? That's just for herself, and she should be here in Burma trying to deal with the problems in Burma, especially with all the communal violence taking place at the moment. So I think in Burma, a lot of people, they're not so aware of the sort of international issues that would, and why Suu Kyi believes it's very important to go around European countries to tell people what's going on in the country, to try and encourage the right sort of investment if there is going to be investment there. People there, they're struggling in their day-to-day life. They have, they have great hope. But, for a lot of people in Burma, although we've heard a lot about the political changes, that hasn't really trickled down to the ordinary people on the streets, and certainly in the ethnic states, who make up about 40% of the population, they haven't seen any change at all. So there's still a lot of cynicism in Burma. There's a lot of caution. There's hope for the first time, but I think for this trip, the exiles, because maybe 10% of Burma's population has been forced to flee the country from human rights abuses and poverty. So there's a huge amount of excitement from Burmese exiles around the world about this trip, and people are very excited that they might be able to see her in person for the first time.
Indeed. And just briefly, when we look at sort of the coming years for Suu Kyi and Burma, I mean, what do you think it's realistic for her to be able to achieve now that she's an MP, now that her party is able to stand properly in elections?
Well, there are full elections due in Burma at the end of 2015, and the NLD, her party, are determined to try and win as many of those seats as possible. But even if they won every seat, they would still only have 75% of the seats in parliament, 25% are reserved for the military, which gives them an effective veto over any constitutional change that might actually turn Burma into a democracy. So 2015, the elections will be a key test. 2016 is when they will push for constitutional change. That's when the military have to say yes or no to constitutional change and Burma becoming a democracy. So that will be the real crunch point.
OK, Mark Farmer from Burma Campaign UK, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. And we'll continue now with some music. This is Kelly by When Saints Go Machine, the Danish quartet, as I'm sure you know, who are playing later tonight at Barcelona's Sonar Music Festival, which kicked off a little earlier today. That was Kelly by When Saints Go Machine. In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be talking architecture with Hugo MacDonald, Congo with Ben Rawlance, and I'll be prattling on about my favourite journalism films. But first, the news headlines with Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Steve. The Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi has been addressing the International Labour Organization conference in Geneva on the first day of her European tour. It's only the second trip she's taken out of Burma in almost a quarter of a century. She said enormous progress has since been made towards political reform in the country and her eyes are firmly on the future. The French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius says he's to propose giving the United Nations the power to enforce Kofi Annan's Syrian peace plan. He says a no-fly zone is an option under consideration to stem what is now a civil war. His comments were the toughest yet from a major power in response to the relentless violence in Syria. 50 international aid groups and United Nations agencies have issued a joint appeal calling on Israel to lift its blockade of the Gaza Strip. Amongst the signatories were Amnesty International, Save the Children, the World Health Organization, Oxfam, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and five other UN bodies. The British Prime Minister, David Cameron, has told the Leveson inquiry into media standards that his predecessor, Gordon Brown, had cooked up a specious and unjustified conspiracy theory about a deal between the Conservatives and media group News International. Mr. Cameron said the suggestion was complete nonsense, adding that he'd never traded a policy in return for media backing. Egypt's ruling military council has gone into emergency session after the country's Supreme Court ordered the lower house of parliament to be dissolved. The court ruled that last year's election was unconstitutional and that a third of the seats elected under the first-past-the-post system were illegitimate. In another ruling, the court ruled that a law banning senior officials from President Mubarak's regime from standing for office was also unconstitutional. Pakistan's foreign minister says NATO should apologise for an airstrike which killed 24 of its soldiers last year if it wants her government to reopen transit routes to foreign troops in Afghanistan. Those routes have been closed for some time, and NATO's Secretary General said yesterday that reopening them would greatly assist the withdrawal of troops and equipment when NATO begins to wind down its mission in Afghanistan. South Africa's new National Police Commissioner says she's determined to root out corruption. Mangwashi Riafiego, who's the first woman to hold the job, was appointed after her predecessor was fired by President Zuma on Tuesday. She previously worked in business before the president picked her to chair the state-owned Enterprises Review Committee. She says she's ready for the challenges of her new job. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. You're listening to Midori House. But then you knew that, really, didn't you? Now, yesterday, our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, wasn't in the office. He was sorely missed. He spent the day judging the new London Architecture Awards. Sadly, he's sworn to secrecy when it comes to revealing the winner. But despite that, I'm pleased to say he joins me in Studio One now to talk about what he saw.
Hello. Well, I should first of all say winners.
Winners.
There was an overall winner, but it was a very long day. We started at 8 in the morning and finished, well, long after dark, because we had an enormous number of categories to get through. And I should probably start by saying that the new London Architecture Awards is an annual awards given to anything that's been built in the city or anything that's been unbuilt in the city but has gone through planning process in the last year. And it takes in everything from public space to homes to offices, transport and infrastructure, master plans, health, education, conservation, hotels.
So pretty much everything.
It was everything. I mean, honestly, I've never looked at so many buildings in one day. But each category, it was very interesting. Each category had its own expert assessor who came in and delivered a really brilliant sort of introduction to all the shortlisted projects in that category. And it was sort of a bit like having an entire contemporary architecture degree squashed into one day, being lectured on this amazing wealth of projects.
And then how do you judge them individually? Are you looking then at photos, at sort of testimony from people that say what they're like? How does it work? Since you can't obviously go around to visit them all.
No, exactly. I mean, it would take a year to visit all of them. What they do
Quite
is they put to
year.
Yeah, and so somebody submits their entry with a package which has a lot of photos, a sort of explanation. Some people almost entered a book. The expert assessor has gone through and whittled maybe sort of 50 entries in one category down to 10. And we have all of their material as well as the assessor's sort of verdict on why this deserve to be put through into a shortlist. We look at all the supporting material. We hear what the assessor, who will have visited these projects, sort of says about them, what the reaction's been, how the public are using them, you know, what the likelihood is that it will be sort of embraced by the city, that it's not just a sort of monument that's been plonked there as a sort of signature of the architect who's built it. And then we argue for a little bit and choose a winner.
Good arguing or...?
It was very good arguing. I should say that people who I can tell you that were on the jury with me are each amazing people from different cities. Dominique Alba, who looks after urban planning in Paris, was there. David Burney, who's the commissioner for the New York City Department of Design and Construction. Ricardo Marini, who's the city design leader in Edinburgh. And Monica van Schmalensee, who is the CEO of White Architecture from Stockholm. And that was overseen by the chairman, Peter Murray, who is one of London's greatest architectural critics.
So quite a panel then?
Quite a panel. The interesting thing is that it was very international, and I've been on architecture juries before in British architecture awards where it's only UK people who are there and everything is infected with, we can't give them an award because, you know, we know what they did 10 years ago and that was awful. Whereas here you have people who obviously sort of know about the bigger projects that are going on. But what was really nice was that there were so many small projects or projects by practices that would never be given an award if people sort of knew who the firm was and, you know, people building wimpy homes or something. And yet actually based on the merits of what they provide and what the assessor says to us and having a panel of people from different cities with different takes on things, you reach some interesting conclusions.
Without giving us any clues as to who any of the winners might be, could you perhaps talk about one category in particular that was quite strong and give us an idea of some of the contenders?
Education, surprisingly, given Michael Gove lambasts what's happening to schools in this country, the education category was way and above the strongest. And whereas a category like homes, which in the UK we're constantly being told that it's only private architecture or architecture for private homes that is sort of the sector that's rising, were dreadful in terms of the quality of the architecture.
Really?
And sort of the ideas behind it. It's just a lot of lazy building plans or sort of nothing particularly inspirational.
Well, let's talk about schools and education. Is this all new builds or is there a lot of sort of...
No, this was all new builds that we saw. And I mean, it spanned quite a huge range of projects as well, because everything... the requirements for a primary school are very different to the requirements for a university building. So we ended up looking at about 15 projects in total. And it was a mixture of new builds and conversions. And each one had been addressed in such an interesting way of looking, taking into account how children would use the spaces or how students would use the spaces. For a student building, it would be how the students can connect with the city as a whole. For younger children, it's about how they don't feel sort of intimidated by space. And for people in between, it's sort of how people going through quite a difficult stage of life, like puberty, might sort of be able to sort of learn well and not be distracted by architecture.
And do you get the sense that the public sector is able to sort of think creatively enough, or at least think creatively enough to employ people who think very creatively?
Well, this is what would be suggested. They weren't just private schools that we were looking at, and really it's about simplicity, thinking about how you ventilate a building well, how you can get as much natural light into it. I mean, these are things that sort of people, the greatest architects, spend their entire lives trying to sort of master the art of. But actually what was shown in all of the education projects that we looked at is that it can be done incredibly simply on a low budget, and not, you know, the buildings are still interesting at the end of the day as well.
And how long do you have to keep shtum about this until the awards are announced?
I can reveal all in the first week of July.
Okay. Good. Well, you have to do that. Are you allowed to do that here?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, good. Excellent. Brilliant. Well, you'll be back on Midori House in the first week of July to find out who's won at the new London Architecture Awards. Hugo MacDonald, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to be changing tack and talking all about Congo right after this.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On the 16th and 17th of June, please join us at Midori House, the London headquarters of Monocle, as we break out the bunting for the very first Monocle Country Fair, our unique global take on a gloriously English tradition, complete with market stalls hosted by some of our favourite nations and shopkeepers. We'll have face painting for children, marvellous musical performances, a guest chef in the kitchen, and much more. The Monocle Country Fair will be running from 11 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon on the 16th and 17th of June at Midori House, 1 Dorset Street, in the heart of London's Marylebone. For more information, head to monocle.com/countryfair, and that's fair with a Y, of course.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It is 18:40 here in London, and it's also 18:40 in Kinshasa. Now, the dubiously titled Democratic Republic of Congo has attracted explorers and writers for more than two centuries, really. In the 1800s, it was Joseph Conrad and Henry Morgan Stanley. In the last decade or so, it has been less celebrated, but certainly, in my opinion, far smarter and interesting writers like Adam Hochschild, Michaela Wrong and Jason Stearns. There's a tendency to focus on Congo's negatives, its devastating wars in the 1990s, its ongoing clashes in the east of the country, its corruption, lack of democracy, the list really can go on. My next guest, Ben Rawlance, prefers to dwell on the positives. His new book, Radio Congo, Signals of Hope from Africa's Deadliest War, traces his three-month journey through the country as he finds the sorts of stories that don't tend to make the front pages. Ben, welcome to Midori House.
Thanks for having me.
You start the book with a quote from Henning Mankell. Still, there are too many people in Europe who only know how Africans are dying, not how they live. And is that essentially the sort of the thought that drove you through this project?
Absolutely. It's kind of ironic that I work for Human Rights Watch, which makes a living out of promoting all the bad stories, emphasising all the bad stuff. And I took a sabbatical from Human Rights Watch to go in search of more hopeful experiences. And that was really what was taking me to Congo. And as you eloquently described, Congo has been a source of such negativity. And even in my experience, where I've worked in Somalia, Nigeria, various places where there's a lot of sadness, there was always, of course, chinks of light. And I thought, Congo's a test case. Let's go there and see if that holds true, even in Africa's deadliest war.
And amongst the things you did was, you know, things like getting drunk.
Getting drunk a lot. Yes. I mean, I think that the difficulty about the media's perception of Africa partly comes from the fact that journalists rush in and rush out. They're on tight budgets, they're on tight deadlines, they're working for sub-editors who want shocking headlines, and the easy shortcut to drama is death, rape, destruction, and so on. And these other stories take longer. You've got to spend time with people, which means, yes, getting drunk with them, travelling on a boat for a week with five guys who tell you the stories of how that boat was used in the war and what it's doing now, and you know, the dynamics of fishing, how people make a living. Any story can be interesting. That's up to the reporter, I think, to find out about those characters, to construct drama out of the everyday.
I mentioned getting drunk not just because that's what journalists are known for, but because, you know, Congo has, you know, actually incredible sort of brewery history, and it's sort of part of life there in a way that perhaps doesn't always come across.
Yeah, absolutely. And therefore, when I got to Manono, this kind of lost city in the jungle that used to be the world's biggest tin mine, and a modernist mecca for town planners who, influenced by Le Corbusier, this place is now a kind of falling down, it's like a museum in a way. And there, when I got there, there was this brewery called Nyota, which is no longer functioning, and everybody was so proud about this beer and reminisced about it in longing tones. And when the barges started flowing again up the Congo River from the capital of Katanga, Lubumbashi, bringing Simba, which is a substitute for Nyota, but a fantastic beer in its own right, when that started arriving back in Manono, it was a source of celebration. And of course, there were no bars, there was no infrastructure, so people just bought crates of the stuff and set up shop in their own houses. So every night you were going to a, you know, Chez Robert, Chez Martin, Chez Jean-Baptiste. And it was amazing, absolutely. And, you know, of course, the stories were sad, but there were also plenty of stories of resilience and hope as well.
What is it about Congo, do you think, that attracts writers, journalists, you know, we talked about explorers before, that perhaps other countries in Africa that, you know, that may be sort of economically more important or politically more important doesn't? Because, I mean, even, you know, as we were just saying, in the last decade, you know, you've had King Leopold's Ghost by Adam Hochschild, you've had In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz by Michaela Wrong, Dancing in the Glory of Monsters by Jason Stearns, a number of books about Congo, and now your own as well, which you certainly haven't had on, you know, Kenya or Nigeria.
I think it captures the imagination partly because of the literary history. I think and that started with the tradition of intrepid explorers and Stanley, you know, the historic crossing of the continent by the Daily Telegraph correspondent. Every step of the way, breathlessly reported. You know, that set the standard and also set, I think, created the mystique. So Congo has always occupied that kind of place in the European imagination. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is the story told by Adam Hochschild in King Leopold's Ghost of the incredible exploitation of the country, how, you know, Belgium's Belgium's economy in the 21st century is pretty much reliant on Congolese resources, the chopping off of everybody's hands to get the rubber out of the forest. So that story, which was, you know, the backdrop to Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, also, I think, is the ultimate foil, I think, to any sort of idea of human progress. It's the dark side, in fact, of the Europeans' narrative of themselves. Now, that's what Joseph Conrad was talking about. Here's what we're really capable of. Here's the kind of raping and pillaging that we can do, that does happen, that you don't always hear about. So there's something about Congo there that's the sort of darker recesses of the European mind, I think. Which,
and yet, frustratingly, the phrase "Heart of Darkness" has become a shorthand for Congo itself in the minds of many.
Yes, I mean, that's the terrible thing, is that despite many years of progress and innovation and, you know, incredible cultural richness and diversity that has happened in since then, Congo now is solely understood in those terms. I imagine it's been a very long journey for Congo to get away from that moniker. And now all of a sudden they find themselves too easily falling back into it. And I think it's very frustrating for them. And it's very frustrating, I think, for Central Africans in general. As we saw in the response to the Kony 2012 video, Africans across the continent said, this is not the place that we know. It might be what you know, or what the Western press thinks it knows about Africa, but this is not our home. So I just wanted to give a little bit of a glimpse in this book about exactly that, how Africans do live. And it's surprising and it's interesting, and in ways that I think are actually more surprising and interesting than just stories of rape and war.
Indeed. And also, if you read it, you find out all about blood cheese.
Indeed.
Ben Rawlins, thank you very much indeed for coming in. The book is Radio Congo, Signals of Hope from Africa's Deadliest War. Thank you very much indeed, Ben. We're going to actually stay in Congo for a moment. Here's a track by the half Congolese, half Ukrainian singer Gaetana. She represented Ukraine in last month's Eurovision Song Contest, finishing 15th with her song Be My Guest. But we prefer this track of hers from 2007. This is Dva Vikna. And that was Gaetana with Dva Vikna. You're listening to Midori House. From His Girl Friday to All the President's Men, every journalist has their favourite film about our trade. Mine, for what it's worth, is The Insider. We love them because they tend to show us in a heroic light, breaking stories that bring down governments or uncovering corporate corruption. They don't tend to show the less glamorous side of journalism, the typing, the phoning, the admin. All this month, the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts is showing a handful of great journalism films. Tonight, it's Sweet Smell of Success with Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis. Karen Gisoni is the organiser of the Bernstein Award for Journalism and the co-curator of the festival, All the News That's Fit to Screen. And she joins me from New York now. Karen, welcome to Midori House. Now, look, I love the idea, but I'm a journalist. What about non-journalists? What are they going to get out of this?
Well, I think the idea for this film series was that the library presents this annual award for journalism every year that we give to a working reporter. And as a way of kind of raising the profile and sort of focusing on working journalists and the important work they do, we thought we would screen these five films to sort of bring the public in and also show the different kinds of journalism. Each film sort of screens a different type of journalism. For example, tonight, The Sweet Smell of Success is about two gossip, if you will, reporters. The first screening we had 2 weeks ago, Shattered Glass, was about Stephen Glass, the reporter who wrote for The New Republic and was exposed for his falsely, you know, creating these stories in 1998. So each week it's a different, and next week we'll show a documentary.
And so what do these films show us? I mean, what do you think they say about the profession of journalism, if we can call it profession?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we want to try to say is to put the focus on it and show how important the work is that journalists do in all sort of areas, not only investigative, in-depth reporting, which of course is, you know, extremely important. And also I think with this series, we're also having a little bit of fun. We're kind of showing, we showed Woman of the Year last year with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn that had, you know, some really sort of had some important things to say, but also was really just so entertaining, and they're, you know, kind of being with them for 2 hours and their whole chemistry and rapport.
You're showing, you know, films over a period of several decades. By watching all of these films, do you get a sense of how journalism has changed over those years?
I think I would say that it seems, it seems like there's more sort of serious kinds of films lately, more recently. I mean, you mentioned The Insider. There's just from All the President's Men forward, there seems to be more, sort of more serious. I can't think, I was thinking about, you know, what was published, the films from the 40s, and they had a little bit more of a His Girl Friday and Woman of the Year.
And now they tend to be a bit more sort of, you know, good night and good luck,
perhaps,
sort of.
I think, yeah.
Yeah. And in terms of, you know, attracting crowds to these films, have your audiences been mainly filled with other journalists, or have you sort of had some success in attracting a sort of a broader audience?
I think it's been so far the first 2 weeks we've had some journalists there, but we've had large just general public, people that are either familiar with the different film series and programs at the Lincoln Center, New York Public Library, or people that have read about the award. I think also we are screening, you know, with each screening we're following up with a Q&A with a journalist somehow relevant to the film we've just shown. So, for example, tonight we have The Sweet Smell of Success, and we're having two gossip columnists, two journalists that write entertainment and gossip that are going to be with us after the film for a Q&A. And that seems to be really, people seem to be really sort of engaged. You know, there's a lot of, you know, questions and back and forth. So I do think that it's bringing in a broader audience, yes.
You're screening these films at a time when journalism's in some real difficulties, particularly in the US. You know, every week we hear about another city newspaper that's in trouble. Do you get the sense that, you know, if a journalism film was made in a decade's time, you know, it might be very, very different from the sort of things you're showing right now?
Yeah, I suppose it's possible. It's interesting. That's an interesting question, because when we screened Shattered Glass 2 weeks ago, we had Adam Pennenberg with us that night, who was the journalist that broke the story in 1998. And at that time, he was writing for Forbes.com, which was a news site, and really I think the first or the second online news site. And he talked a lot about that and how that was, at that time, that was sort of rogue reporting. I mean, that was considered, you know, really not, people were questioning it. So when he was writing, and you saw that in the film as well, when you were writing that story, it was sort of looked upon with a lot of skepticism. And it's kind of interesting now when you think about that 12 years later and how much that landscape has changed. So I think we're really in a period of, I mean, things are just transitioning and changing. And, you know, we just don't know what it's going to look like in 10 years.
No, but we certainly don't.
Now.
Okay, Karen Gisoni, thank you very much indeed. The festival continues every Thursday until the end of the month. If you're in New York, do go. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. The producer was Marcus Hippie, the studio manager Toby Hammond. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Urbanist, hosted by Andrew Tuck. Today they'll speak about the role of mayors with Liverpool's first ever directly elected mayor.
One of the things that strengthens me as an individual, as mayor of Liverpool, of course, is that the minister and other government ministers know that we have a large mandate, an extremely strong mandate, an extremely strong voice speaking on behalf of the city of Liverpool.
And there's also an app-guided wander through Dublin and lots more. That's coming up right after the news. Midori House, we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Andrew will be here, sat in this seat. Don't forget, of course, the Monocle Daily is here with Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson at 2200 hours London time. Until then, that was Midori House. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much. Goodbye.